2000's march against the mistreatment of Indigenous people on Australia's National Day, an occasion they call Invasion Day. Another dark page in Canada's history. Indigenous leaders in British Columbia identify 93 unmarked graves at a residential school site. And the U.S. president warns Moscow of damaging sanctions, including measures personally targeting his Russian counterpart over the crisis in Ukraine. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, historical anger against the mistreatment of Indigenous people in Australia continues to this day, and it has drawn thousands of protesters into the streets once again.
We say murder! We say murder!
The protesters waved flags of Aboriginals and held signs reading "No Pride in Genocide." They argue that Australia always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Australia's 700,000 Indigenous people are near the bottom when it comes to economic and social indicators. They live in remote areas where there is no access to government facilities. Some protesters said Australians need to be more responsible for the way the Indigenous people are being treated.
Australia Day is not the day to celebrate. Represents a day of mourning for Aboriginal people, and I don't think that it's right that we celebrate Australia Day on January 26th.
January the 26th also marks the date the British fleet sailed into Sydney Harbour in 1788 to start a colony there. The date is officially known as Australia Day, but protesters call it Invasion Day. They're demanding a change to the date or its total abolition, arguing that it's a day of mourning for the Indigenous people. Canada is once again in the headlines for its dark history. An Indigenous group has found scores of potential new unmarked graves at a former residential school known for abuse. The latest such discovery over the past year, the group says preliminary results of a geophysical search in British Columbia have uncovered, quote, 93 reflections believed to be unmarked grave sites. Hundreds of unmarked graves have been discovered at former residential school sites across Canada since more than a year ago. The discoveries have fueled widespread calls for justice and accountability for the victims. Between 1800s and 1990, Canada forced more than 150,000 Indigenous children to attend residential schools. The children were stripped of their language and culture, separated from their families, and subjected to psychological, physical, and sexual abuse. Ryan Dawson is a human rights activist. Listen to him explain why the finding of these grave sites is a dark stain in Canada's history.
It's horrible yet good in a dark way, because they're finally getting recognition for these abuses. If these 93 graves turn out to be more mass graves, that's over 1,967 bodies, mostly children, that have been found buried in unmarked graves at these residential schools. It's bad enough to find the mass graves and all these children who were dying in these schools, but even those who survived, you have to realize that they were yanked from their families against their will and forced to speak English, not to use native languages. They cut their hair, they put them in uniforms, they were beaten, they were sexually abused, mentally abused, forced into physical labor. A lot of them died. So they yanked kids away from their parents in Canada and in the U.S. It didn't feed them at this school, and of course, when you're malnourished, that's why you die from diseases you normally would be able to fight off. And this went on for hundreds of years. This wasn't a one-generation thing. This went on for a very long time.
Iran's president says an agreement could be reached on the 2015 deal if other parties remove sanctions they imposed on the Islamic Republic.
There are some whispers about the U.S. requesting to hold direct negotiations with Iran. If these requests are serious, what will be Iran's definitive stance? These requests have been made not recently, but they have been made for a long time.
Many of the countries that hold meetings with us sometimes carry messages that the Americans have requested direct talks. This is not limited to the present, but has existed for a long time even under the previous Iranian administrations. No direct talks have so far been held with the Americans. However, what is clear, as we have stated before and we state now, is that if the other sides are ready to remove the cruel sanctions imposed on the Iranian people, there is room for any kind of agreement.
Ebrahim Raisi says that Tehran will not tie all of the country's affairs to the ongoing talks. In Vienna, Raisi says Iran is pursuing a double approach to U.S. sanctions. They're neutralization and removal. According to the Iranian president, the impact of sanctions can also be nullified through boosting relations with Iran's neighbors, including Russia. Washington unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 deal with Tehran and reimposed sanctions against Iran. An eighth round of talks is underway in the Austrian capital as part of efforts aimed at reviving the pact. The American social media giant Facebook has permanently removed the page of Iranian news channel Hispan TV. According to the channel's website, Facebook has not given any prior warning or explanation about the shutdown of the page. Hispan TV has described the move as an attack on freedom of expression. Back in October, the American company temporarily blocked the page, which has more than 1.4 million followers. Hispan TV, along with a number of Iranian media outlets, has repeatedly been the target of media censorship by U.S. technology platforms such as Google, YouTube, and Twitter. Iranian authorities blast the media crackdown as a flagrant violation of freedom of expression. The Yemeni army has launched a massive retaliatory operation against Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The Saudi-led coalition has in recent days ramped up its strikes on Yemen and in the UAE, and rather the UAE is taking a huge gamble on retaliatory strikes given that its participation in the war is threatening Yemen's stability and economy. Now Yemenis say they'll continue their cross-border strikes as long as the war and siege on their country last.
The Yemeni army has launched a massive retaliatory operation against Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the two allies waging war on the country since 2015. It says vital and sensitive targets were accurately struck with drones and missiles.
They targeted the Safra airport. They also hit the Abu Dhabi airport with a big number of ballistic missiles, Zulfiqar. They targeted facilities in the area of Dubai with a big number of drones and unmanned planes of Samad 3. Also, several military posts in the heart of the Saudi area, in the area of Shobra, and other Saudi towns with a great number of Samad 1 unmanned planes and also artillery fire. They hit very sensitive areas in Jazan and Asir, also with a big number of ballistic missiles.
Sari said the Yemeni army would continue its retaliatory attacks and respond to escalation with escalation. Saudi Arabia and the UAE have both confirmed the retaliatory strikes, but said they intercepted the ballistic missiles. The attack comes just a week after Yemeni forces struck several targets inside the Emirati soil using drones and ballistic missiles.
This conflict has been doomed from the start, from the Saudi and UAE perspective, from the perspective of the coalition, from the perspective of the invaders. There is no chance for them to win. That's why there are several countries that are officially part of this coalition or allies of this coalition who have in reality barely contributed to it because they know there is no point to it.
The strikes are part of the reprisal attacks over the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and plunged the country into the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
The Yemeni army has warned that the United Arab Emirates won't be able to withstand its future strikes. It sure has a point, as the damage dealt to the Sheikhdom won't be limited to its bases and facilities, but will also target its economy. After the second Yemeni attack, the Dubai stock index saw its biggest fall in over a month on Monday. Will the military and economic pressure push Abu Dhabi to change course?
Following Yemen's latest attack on the UAE, the U.S. Embassy and its consular mission in the Emirates advised Americans there to, quote, maintain a high level of security awareness. The statement urges U.S. citizens to take appropriate steps to bolster their personal security. The American Embassy issued a similar alert last week when the UAE was targeted by Yemeni missiles and drones. The Yemeni army is now warning international firms and investors to leave the UAE as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues its aggression against Yemen. The sheikhdom is now feeling the economic consequences of the attacks. On Monday, the Dubai stock index fell by 2%, while Abu Dhabi stocks closed lower.
This has been very damaging for the economy of the UAE, which is based completely on trade, on commerce, on being a transit hub for both material and non-material trading and products that go around here. That's the only real thing that the country floats on. Without this commercial backing, the country has no future, and they think they know that very well.
Last week, the impoverished nation was hit by another round of brutal strikes by the Saudi war machine that targeted a prison, claiming dozens of more innocent lives. The Yemenis have shown that the continuous onslaught on their nation won't weaken their resolve to defend their country.
Afghans representing the diaspora have gathered in protest outside number 10 Downing Street. Afghanistan is in a race against time, with international organization warning of mass starvation and poverty if the international community doesn't step up. Yanka Raimi tells us more from London.
The humanitarian crisis unfolding in Afghanistan is dire. The UN says virtually every man, woman and child in Afghanistan could face acute poverty. The World Food Programme says 98% of Afghans aren't getting enough to eat. Millions are already starving and millions are on the brink. Afghans living outside the country are trying to raise awareness, but their cries are falling on deaf ears.
The Afghan diaspora, 80,000 strong here in the UK and millions strong worldwide, feels abandoned. The West, led by the US, has left Afghanistan in tatters and at the mercy of the Taliban. And to add insult to injury, billions of dollars worth of Afghan money has been frozen.
To be exact, much of the $9.4 billion in Afghan currency reserves in Afghanistan's central bank. The country is now functionally cut off from many foreign banks and unable to access its reserves.
We call upon all the international charities and NGOs to return back to Afghanistan and to resume their help, because the people of Afghanistan need their help more than ever now.
We believe it's possible for committees of working people in the urban areas, in the farming areas, to start to coordinate, to distribute those resources to those in need, and ultimately to link up, to take power out of the hands of the Taliban, of the supporters of United States capitalism, or any invading power which is there to suck money out of the region.
The US withdrawal was messy and slipshod. The world watched dumbfounded as planes took off from Kabul with desperate Afghans hanging off them, terrified of Taliban rule. Since then, the country has been knocked back decades. Girls have been denied education and women driven out of their places of work.
They are the one who make that mess, and they need to clean it. They can't just left the mess and run away. That's what they did. They educated people. They bring that thing, that sense of hope in the past 20 years, and then they just bang the door on their face and run away.
The UN is launching its largest ever single country aid appeal for Afghanistan, describing its plight as one of the world's most rapidly growing humanitarian crises. The amount they need? Around $5 billion, half the amount languishing in the country's central bank under US sanctions. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Elsewhere, the latest on the ongoing tensions over Ukraine. Russia says its southern neighbor is being flooded with consignments of weapons and countless advisors from the U.S. and NATO. Russia's representative to the United Nations warns that Washington is cultivating Russophobia among its citizens and allies. The U.S. and some NATO members say they've placed thousands of troops on high alert, with the White House warning Russian invasion of Ukraine could come at any moment. President Joe Biden has even threatened to directly target President Vladimir Putin with sanctions if Russian troops amassed at the border attack Ukraine. But the Kremlin says that it has the right to freely move military forces on its own soil because it feels threatened by NATO's expansion to the east. Russia is opposed to Ukraine becoming a member of the Western alliance. Paul Sheldon Foote is a professor at California State University. He says Joe Biden's current policies towards Ukraine are rooted in his political failure at home. Let's have a listen.
This time around, the crazy one is President Biden. He's saying that we'll be launching an invasion that would resemble what we did in World War II. Excuse me? World War II, we had a draft. World War II, we turned a lot of domestic factories into building war equipment. How many Americans are going to tolerate having their automobile plants and other major factories closed down to make war equipment to satisfy President Biden's desperate needs for re-election, because everything's going bad domestically for him, and we have terrible inflation and terrible economic problems. So this is a great way for him to divert attention. He's done very little right. We have massive inflation going on, by American standards at least. And he knows that in November's elections, there will probably be a change in the control of the House of Representatives. So he's scared, and this is a good diversion. Unfortunately, we have hotheads in the American military too, just as we did during the Cuban Missile Crisis, who would have been very happy to lob missiles into the Soviet Union back in then. We have hotheads in the military here who overestimate their abilities.
That's a wrap for now.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
see you too.
Chuman.
Yani?
Bazaar. Simply put, wheat is part of the grass family. Some have argued that wheat domesticated mankind, bringing humans away from the colorful and adventurous hunter-gatherer lifestyle and settling them permanently next to their fields. It is also said that wheat is responsible for the agricultural revolution. It has supplied the calories that made it possible for the world's population to race toward 8 billion people. Presently, wheat is grown on more land areas across the world than any other food crop. Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of Bozar, the weekly program that analyzes industries, markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we will venture through the vast agriculture industry. We wanted to see how its products are linked to the booming food sector and uncover why it is so important to the economy. So let's get started. Our quest for answers took us to Jor-A Company. It was established nearly four decades ago and specializes in producing flour. This flour mill has massive production halls, which houses the latest machinery used in this business. Everything coming out of the flour mill is inside each grain of wheat, and none of it is wasted. Anything that is not used for human consumption is used for animal feed. It all starts with the wheat that is brought to the mill. Wheat that enters the facilities is sampled and tested before anything else is done. It is analyzed for moisture, gluten, and other characteristics. If it meets the standards, then it is taken to be stored. The miller's job is to separate the grain into different parts. Inside each grain is flour, bran, and germ. This is a gradual process that involves lots of sieving and sifting using giant machines in a closed-circuit process. The second stage, after crushing wheat into coarse fragments, is to add moisture, and it is stored in a separate area for 12 hours. This stage prepares the wheat for further sifting to separate bran and fine flour and is tested again for particular characteristics. Now it is ready for the final grinding phase, where it will be sifted some more. Back in the day, these processes used to be done by stone presses, and it was much faster. It might have taken 10 minutes to make stone grout flour, but with modern mills, the grinding process might take over an hour to complete. Different components of wheat are separated and later recombined to make different blends of flour, which might include bran as well. The final product is either white and bran or wholemeal flour. At this stage, it is finally ready for packaging and distribution. Over the years, this company has expanded its production such that now it produces 12 times more flour on a daily basis compared to when it started out. The production line uses state-of-the-art machinery that has been imported from Germany and Italy to get the job done. An important aspect of quality production is the different types of massive storage silos, as well as the raw material this company uses. Having a clear vision for production is also key in maintaining quality, but that's easier said than done. This company believes that having a bright plan for the future and an outline of steps to execute such a plan is critical to a smooth mass production. The mill produces flour along the lines of exports and adheres to national and international standards for production, safety, and quality. Producing the highest quality of products to satisfy its customers is, of course, its main priority. This company has overcome numerous obstacles in order to enjoy its many achievements over the years. One such a hurdle in its journey has been the U.S.-imposed economic sanctions, which has hindered many exporting processes for the businesses. Now, a lot of work and effort goes into farming wheat. The right location, soil conditions, seeds, germination, water, and so much more all make up the ingredients for a good harvest. Over the years, the government has implemented several plans and schemes to help support farmers and wheat productions nationwide. So at the present time, how is the wheat production like in the country? Around 6 million hectares of land across the country are used for farming. That is a 2.5 million hectare increase in land area used to plant crops compared to previous years. About a third of wheat fields in Iran are irrigated and the rest is rain-fed, which makes these crops vulnerable to rainfall variation. That's all according to the National Foundation of Wheat Growers. In March 2020, the government announced a scheme to purchase nearly 75% of domestic wheat productions at guaranteed prices. The goal was to reduce reliance on imports for domestic consumption. However, farmers thought that the government purchased wheat brought them little profit. As a result, some farmers opted to sell their wheat for animal feed at a higher price instead. So the government increased its purchase price to make up for the deficits. Wheat production has witnessed many ups and downs over the years. This year, farmers are dealing with droughts and pests such as locusts, as well as an increase in the cost of fertilizers and seeds. Consequently, there has been a 30% decrease in wheat harvest this year. In order to remedy the situation, the government has granted permission to import wheat and increase the production of seeds as well. Wheat is believed to be an inseparable part of our everyday food, as it can be used for various meals like pasta, bread, cookies, and so much more. It's considered a strategic crop because it can be transformed into different products with added value, which increases profits. In the world today, the food industry is worth billions and is growing at a rapid pace. As you probably know, the national food production is heavily dependent on productions in the agriculture industry. The food industry is the biggest contributor to the national economy. Going off the figures from Iran's Customs Administration, this sector makes up over 20% of Iran's non-oil revenues. This industry is almost entirely privately owned too, and for those who want to enter this sector, it offers a world of opportunities. The food sector also holds the largest share in creating jobs in the country and accounting for around 50% of the country's entire industrial employment. That's according to the Ministry of Industries, Mining and Trade. Over 5 million tons of agricultural and food products were exported from Iran in the first 8 months of this year. Based on data from the Ministry of Agriculture, these exports raked in roughly $3.3 billion. It might be interesting to know pistachios top the exporting charts in terms of value. Dairy products, sweets, poultry and aquaculture, as well as a diverse range of agricultural products, are some of the main items exported this year. Iran exports these items to numerous market destinations across the world, including countries in Europe, Asia, and South America. All right, everyone, it's time for me to take you out on the field to walk you through the production procedure of a material that we use on a day-to-day basis. I won't tell you any further. Let's begin the adventure. One of the major innovations of the past centuries has been the introduction and wide adaptation of plastics for many day-to-day applications. The mass use of plastic started in the 1950s and has steadily grown ever since. Today, more than 300 million tons of plastic are produced worldwide every year. The popularity of plastic is due not only to its low production costs, but also its numerous practical characteristics, including its low weight, acid resistance, and flexibility.
In our everyday lives, we interact with thousands of materials that might be hard to imagine life without. One of these frequently used materials is plastic. If we look around, we can see that plastic products are almost everywhere. We go shopping and we end up with loads of plastic bags. We go to the kitchen and we use plastic wrappers for food packaging. But hold on a second. Have you ever wondered how all these plastic products are produced before reaching your hands? Today we decided to come to Sepeed Company and we're gonna go 11 meters underground to see how nylon is produced with these raw materials. So don't go anywhere, stay with me. Now, we are 11 meters underground. As a matter of fact, most of the plastic we see around is manufactured from crude oil. The raw materials, which are mainly polyethylene granules, are transported to the factory in the form of hefty sacks. The first stage of the production process begins with the mixing of the polyethylene granules with other types of chemicals.
All right, this place is very crowded, obviously like any other factory. That is why I have to shout here. After the raw materials are combined with other chemicals, they get to this stage where different steps take place. The first step is suction. There's this thing that sucks in these granules into this funnel. And then this funnel passes the granules through this furnace, or we can call the extruder, where the granules are twisted and turned into a dough-like material at a very high temperature. And then the dough-like material passes through a machine, and the machine molds the dough-like material into a plastic material. And this is the final product. And if you're wondering how it is molded into plastic, how the dough material is turned into plastic, there are some cold air that are blown from beneath that help the dough-like material to be shaped and formed into plastic-like material.
Plastics consist of long molecular chains known as polymers, a word that means made of many parts. When the material reaches the molding stage, some are cooled with cold air and some are frozen with water. And this results in a wide range of plastic products. In case you're wondering how some nylon or plastic bags are colorful, this is when the colorful pellets find their way into the white granules. These colorful pellets are called master batch that are added to the mixture to produce nylons with wide range of colors.
By the end of the molding process, the final product, which is the nylon, is ready. It was really interesting to me, and I think for every single one of you, to realize the fact that the nylon that we see in our everyday lives are actually made of very small and tiny and shiny granules, and then they reach into our hands. So that might be something that hasn't even crossed our mind.
Plastics are responsible for our modern life we enjoy today. But have you ever thought about where all these plastics we use might end up? A great amount of plastic is not recycled and ends up in landfills or the natural environment. And today, plastic pollution is threatening the wildlife and human health.
Today, I figured out that all those plastic bags I receive when I go shopping are actually produced with different patterns in this place. Without a doubt, plastic has so many valuable uses in our day-to-day lives, but we should never neglect the fact that at the same time, it has some irreparable damages on the environment. However, in the modern world today, with the technological innovations, we can replace plastic with eco-friendly alternatives to reduce the waste and save the planet Earth. For now, take care and bye-bye. Well, personally, I always learn from watching the production process of a product that I use every day. I hope you enjoyed it too. Now, without further ado, let's dive right into some interesting news and trends regarding the agricultural industry. With the surge in population, the need for food also increases.
and the agriculture sector is where the country gets most of its food security. That is why now we are seeing a rising trend of the influence of technology on the agriculture industry. According to Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology, solutions to challenges in this area can be found with technology innovation. There are dozens of knowledge-based companies that are active in this field. Some products that have been commercialized include livestock breeding tech and vaccines, biofertilizers, food industry enzymes, and so much more. What better way to get the lay of the land than to get a bird's eye view from a drone? The use of drones in the agriculture sector is increasing as drone production has also gone up inside the country. The use of drones in Iranian farms has risen threefold this year. That's according to the Ministry of Agriculture Mechanization Expansion Center. This technology has been locally manufactured by nearly dozens of domestic companies who have already released 65 new models. The drones are mainly used for spraying pesticides and applying fertilizers. Iran is home to thousands of medicinal plants that naturally grow nationwide. These plants are also widely used in the pharmaceutical industry. Now, Iran is creating 6 new innovation centers to develop the supply chain of medicinal plants in the country. These centers have been established in the cities of Tehran, Kermanshah, and Hamadan, among others. The goal is to pave the way for industries to have easier access to ideas and products in this field. Medicinal plants have been used for centuries in Iranian traditional medicine as well. That wraps up our show for today. Drop us a line with your thoughts and comments via our email. Don't forget to leave us your feedback. And on behalf of the entire team of Bazaar, thank you for tuning in. Stay safe and bye-bye. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zayed Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. So we're trying to understand the social system in Islam, and we're trying to dig deeper into how we are able as individuals to contribute to social justice, to understand what our position is as far as bringing about coexistence and peace and harmony, and in all, you know, just being better people and living that positive life, that spiritual life, all under the umbrella of religion and Islam, and keeping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala content and happy with what it is that we are doing in this world. And I think when we base that on mutual understanding, when we base it on avoiding any kind of tension or whatever will escalate to any kind of rivalry or hostility, that's the best kind of system that we need to live in. When we know that you mediating between people who are at dispute is a best form of ibadah, when we understand that, you know, the best kind of person is someone who people are safe about, you know, they don't need to be worried about how sharp their tongue is or how dangerous they are. They know that this person, he's a passive person, a kind person, a respectable person, you know. Yes, when it comes to issues to do with religion, he or she, they're not someone who compromises, you know, when it comes to something like al-amr bil-ma'ruf wa nahi 'an al-munkar, they don't allow some kind of evil or haram to be practiced or become widely spread in the community. This is something that they clearly against. You know, that's the kind of person you want to be defined as. And here there's also going to be that importance of you assisting others as well. You know, you're mediating, you're also assisting. And I think that's where this topic plays a very, very important role. And that is when it does come to how we need to help and assist and support others in matters of individual need, in matters of collective social need, you're always going to be there for someone. People can rely on you. People can trust you. People know that if they do need something, then you are the person to go to. And that's pretty much the most honorable kind of feature a person can have. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Holy Quran, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, ta'awanu ala al-birri wa taqwa. Assist one another in affairs of righteousness and piety. وَلَا تَعَوَنُوا عَلَى الْإِثْمِ وَالْعُدْوَانِ. And do not assist, do not contribute, do not facilitate in any way towards sin and udwan, transgression, transgressing towards one another, towards each other, or towards anybody else. Surah Al-Ma'idah, verse number 2. And this is exactly why, you know, there are so many ahadith. Let's give you one example from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He says, لَا يَزَالُ النَّاسِ بِخَيْرٍ. People are good, continue to be good as long as لَا يَزَالُ النَّاسِ بِخَيْرٍ مَا أَمَرُوا بِالْمَعْرُوفِ. As long as they do their أمر بالمعروف and their نهي عن المنكر. And this is the point for this episode, وَتَعَاوَنُوا عَلَى الْبِرِّ وَالتَّقْوَى. And they assist each other, they help each other, they contribute to what will allow them to do something righteous.
Ayatollah Javadi Amoli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
For example, you know that this person, if I was to give him or her a certain amount of money, they would do something righteous. Or if I was to help him or her in affairs of their life or in education or whatever it is, that's called ta'awun. You know, you're helping one another in affairs, in issues, in matters that will elevate their social status, their religious status, their education, their wealth, their financial side, whatever it may be, you know, you are contributing to them doing good and righteous and having piety, and also you as well. Here the hadith says, Al-Muslimu Akhul Muslim, La Yadhlimuhu, a Muslim is the brother of another fellow Muslim, who does not oppress each other, they do not oppress them. وَيَحِقُّ عَلَى الْمُسْلِمِينَ الْإِجْتِهَادِ فِي التَّوَاصُلِ وَالتَّعَاوُنِ عَلَى
ta'atuf, and it is something that it is important. It is a right, it is a duty that believers assist and help each other with compassion and connect with each other with compassion and with any form of assistance possible.
I invite you to listen to the continuation of the program on IRIB English Radio.
Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, let me read this hadith, very interesting hadith. Shahidtu fi dari Abdullah ibn Jud'an halfan ma uhibbu anna leaf bihi humurun ni'am wala ud'a bihi fil islami la'ajabt. Which basically means, before the bi'tha, he had that there was like a promise or a vow between him and Abdullah ibn Jud'an. And this was in the sense of defending him. If he was to have called me or held me accountable for that vow, I would have accepted. And that's the whole way of understanding how we need to contribute with one another and assist one another in areas that would make their life better. Now here, we might be talking about religion, we might be talking about money, we might be talking about education, whatever the case may be. There needs to be that level of ta'awun, there needs to be that level of assistance and helping and being there for one another. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.